Rick Rule, investor, speculator, and founder of Rule Investment Media. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here. Wonderful nude backdrop. Congratulations.
Thank you, Rick. It's a work in progress, and building the channel is a work in progress, but still doing my best. And I'm very grateful to have a little bit of your time and guests like yourself to be able to have these conversations with. So, Rick, obviously, you know, there's a ton to talk about in and around the war and what the fallout is going to be from an energy perspective, a food perspective, many different perspectives, limiting things so essential like 20% of LNG, for example, oil, fertilizer, pharmaceuticals. What are the, let's say, the biggest risks of fallout that you see at this point?
Well, I think the first risk that everybody needs to consider is the possibility that the economic slowdown resulting from this will tip us into recession, assuming that we're not already in recession, and precipitate a liquidity squeeze, a credit crisis. I'm not saying it's going to occur, but periods of time when people are concerned, particularly when their concerns are real, can create psychological financial contagion. I'm not saying it's going to occur,
yeah,
but I think this is a wonderful time to stay reasonably liquid. Because if a liquidity crisis does occur, having that liquidity will give you the tools and perhaps the courage to take advantage of the circumstance as opposed to being taken advantage of by the circumstance. Mm-hmm. A little history. I had the good fortune to go into 2008, very liquid. I also had the experience, born of 25 years in capital markets, to know that the circumstance would change. That gave me the courage to employ the capital that foresight had left me. And the consequence of that was that 2009 was the single best investment year of my career. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that 2026 or 2027 will give us a sort of an epochal decline of 2008, of the 2008 circumstance. But if it did, I myself would be ready. And I would ask your listeners to consider how ready they are. I'm not talking about the fact that it's a probability or not a possibility, but if it's a possibility, a liquidity collapse needs to be a contingency that your audience needs to think about insuring against. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm suggesting. This is not a headline number. It's just something that needs to be in the back of every investor and speculator's mind. The second thing I need to say is that this is a continuation of a trend that's been in motion for sort of 10 or 15 years, which is to say resource nationalism and the fact that there will be increasing conflicts, regional conflicts, including conflicts over resources. The lack of flex in the system is evident, and I think it's been evident to what I guess you could call the Chinese bloc and the Euro bloc and the America bloc for some time. And I think the geopolitical circumstance will reinforce nations or groups of nations that they need, to the extent that they can affect it, geopolitically secure sources of all kinds of material goods. One implication of that, ironically, is that it should reduce the cost of capital to resource companies. Companies that have the ability to offer reasonable access to supply security probably will have access to subsidized credit. And I think that will lower the cost of capital. We've already seen, as an example, President Trump enter into an arrangement with Westinghouse, Cameco, Brookfield, et al. To invest as much as $80 billion in U.S. nuclear capacity. There hasn't been an investment in that order of magnitude in the U.S. nuclear business ever. And it wouldn't be occurring today without regulatory harmonization and, in particular, subsidized credit, which is to say, the U.S. taxpayer is about to subsidize the U.S. ratepayer. And I think there are important investment themes around that. Sorry for this long-winded answer, but it's a great big question. The restriction in exports through the Straits of Hormuz has brought forward energy pricing. The energy pricing that we're seeing now is pricing that you and I had talked about in prior interviews, occurring in 2029. And that pricing increase wasn't going to happen because of war, in my estimation, although we did talk about, jokingly, some morons chucking missiles across the straits, if you remember that conversation. Ironic. The forecast for double digit or low triple digit energy prices had everything to do with the lack of sustaining capital investment in the oil and gas business and nothing to do with war. The war brought it forward. But the consequences, as you point out, go beyond oil. They go to liquefied natural gas. They go to helium. They go to nitrogen. They go to nitrogenous fertilizer. They go to uranium, pardon me, aluminum. They go all over the place. And as a throwaway, the great unsung beneficiary, I think, Tom, will be the uranium business. The construction of the Japanese nuclear fleet was in response to the Arab oil embargo in the early part of the decade of the 70s. The Japanese realized that the only fuel that had sufficient energy density, that enough of it could be stored to power Japan for 5 to 10 years, was uranium. They have realized that again, as have the Koreans, as have the Taiwanese, as have the Chinese. And the implications on that for conventional nuclear plant construction in the next 10 years cannot be overstated. The near-term import of the fact that there is now overwhelming political consensus in Japan to increase the pace of Japanese restarts isn't something that increases uranium demand 10 years from now. It's something that increases uranium demand 10 months from now. And that's very relevant.
Well, I do want to get to uranium, absolutely, Rick. And I ask a big question because it gives us a lot of departure angles here. But going back to the idea of a liquidity squeeze here, coming into this, basically into this point in time, into the war, we had a private credit crunch starting. We had an AI, or what a lot of people point to do as an AI bubble. We have, exploding national debts all over the world. It seems like there were a lot of problems coming into this that are only going to be exacerbated by an energy shock. Now, if we add a liquidity crunch, a general liquidity crunch to this, Rick, what do you see as the risks of holding equities and/or even cash in a time like this, in banks or brokerage houses? Do you see the risk of a failure or of bank failures and brokerage house failures when you're holding your equities and/or cash in those places?
I think the probability of system-wide collapse, at least in the United States and Canada, is pretty low. The U.S. banks, from a historic perspective, are reasonably capitalized and have done a reasonably good job. I say reasonably good job. They never do a great job, but a reasonably good job managing credit. Where you're seeing real cracks in credit is private credit. We can talk later about the potential for a crack in the non-investment grade bond markets, which I'm afraid is very, very, very high. I would urge investors, as I always do, to pay attention to the solvency of their financial intermediary. When you and I first met, when I was running a then independent brokerage firm, Global Resource Investments, I looked through clearing arrangements with 16 clearing firms nationwide. I rejected 15 because although I'm pretty good at reading balance sheets and income statements, I couldn't understand the financial condition of 15 of the 16 clearing firms. In particular, the derivatives liabilities surrounding the biggest brokerage firms in the country meant that I couldn't sign clearing agreements with them. I probably did 200 hours worth of work before I inked a clearing agreement with the Royal Bank of Canada, simply because theirs was the only balance sheet I could understand. I wonder how many of your listeners know that they can request a statement of financial condition from their brokerage firm or from their bank. The idea that somebody wouldn't do this is incomprehensible to me, and I bet not 1% of your listeners do it.
Well, if
the same understanding of the nature of the banking industry is what has caused me to be invested in banking. There are qualitative differences between banks. That's precisely why we started Battle Bank. We don't believe for a minute that we can compete with Citicorp or Bank of America, and we don't believe for a minute that they can compete with us. If the circumstance happens where, as an example, the hidden sins on the balance sheet around commercial real estate or time spreads where the banks have lent long, but they've financed it with short-term overnight deposits, to the extent that that comes back and harms the banking system, the idea that you have a small, highly solvent bank with no credit problems, a bank that can expand and lend when its competitors are contracting, is extremely attractive. Our last bank, EverBank, came into 2008 in very, very, very good financial condition, a very, very clean balance sheet, a balance sheet with equity sort of 13% of total assets, compared to 6, which was the average in the U.S. banking system, a real deposit machine, and no legacy sins. The consequence of that is that 2008, 2009, 2010 probably saw a prudent doubling of that business. And so in answer to your question, I think that people who pay attention to this circumstance can actually benefit from it as opposed to be penalized by it. What you will find if we do have a credit contraction is that the price of everything, in movie parlance, the good, the bad, and the ugly, all fall. The good will come back. And if you segregate between the good, the bad, and the ugly, you will come out of this circumstance better off, not worse off. Whether you are a victim or a beneficiary is really up to you.
It's up to you and the amount of due diligence you're willing to
correct
to embark upon. Rick, I was reading a little bit about the risk that you see on a run on high yield ETFs. Why is that also something that that you're warning about or worried about?
Tom, I have to say that scares the hell out of me. Specifically, what we're talking about is the fact that there's a proliferation of exchange-traded funds in the United States that are high-yield ETFs. They probably exist around the world. I'm not familiar with them other places. And the concern is twofold. Many of the people who own these funds are just what we laughingly call yield whores. They're chasing 150 or 200 basis points extra return without understanding the credit risks in the portfolio. And those risks occur in two fashions. The bonds, the non-investment grade bonds, the parlance for them is junk bonds, which are in those portfolios, often have loan conditions and covenants that I, as a lender, would never agree to. They're just too loose with regards to default, with regards to negative pledge, with regards to coverage. There are credit risks that the people who own the ETFs, Moz and Paws, who are just investing for 150 extra basis points, don't understand. These are very sophisticated instruments. The second problem is that while the ETFs themselves are hugely liquid, billions of dollars trade every day. You can get in, you can get out right now with the click of a mouse. The challenge is that the underlying assets, the portfolios of these funds, are highly illiquid. And if we have a situation like 2008, where people become concerned about credit quality, this time corporate credit quality as opposed to real estate credit quality, and the Mas and Pas who own these ETFs begin to redeem, the managers to fund redemptions must sell the underlying bonds, which are hugely illiquid. My joke around that stems back to the old junk bond defaults in the early part of the decade of the 90s. Our nomenclature for junk bonds was owl bonds. And we called them owl bonds because if you called your broker to sell one, your broker would say, "To who? To who?" And that's my real nervousness. My nervousness is that we have a credit contagion, a psychological contagion, similar to 2008. We have Mas and Pas trying to redeem, and the managers aren't able to sell the underlying assets to redeem. That is a run in the bank where the bank has no central guarantor. That's pretty scary. What I've done myself is I'm studying, or rather, I'm commissioning a study by a team of junk bonds in mining, insurance, and oil and gas, three industries that I understand, so that if these bonds ever came into a 75% off sale, I would be a bid, not a generous bid, but a bid.
Rick, can you give us a couple examples of what those ETFs would be so that people can understand that a little bit more?
Anything that advertises itself as high yield, YLD, if they describe themselves as high yield corporate, you're in it. High yield is a marketing euphemism for junk. And by the way, they are reasonably high yield compared to other ETFs like Prime, which invests in prime rate loans, as an example. YLD, probably, well, the high yield universe probably yields 150 or 200 basis points more on a current basis than senior secureds or prime rate trusts. It's just that that extra yield comes with what is to me unacceptable risk.
So, in a time like this, Rick, do you think a ultra millionaire tax is the answer for 99.85% of the population?
I think that's probably one of the dumbest ideas that's ever come out of Washington. And that's saying a lot. Dumb for a whole bunch of reasons. The idea that you punish productivity, that you punish accomplishment, is one of the reasons that our country is in the condition that it's in today. Aspiration is better for the economy than envy, but envy sells better. Everybody wants to blame the billionaires. The second is that it is precisely the billionaires who both create wealth, look at Elon Musk, and allocate, which is to say, they are the investors. A wealth tax on billionaires is the same as eating your seed corn. You are consuming the assets that are providing for your future. The third is the fact that if the rich actually had to pay their share, their fair share, they would need a rebate. People don't get this. The top 1% of all taxpayers pay 42% of the applicable income and capital gains tax. Were they to pay their fair share, when might they expect their rebate? They enjoy 22% of the applicable income and pay 42% of the applicable tax. Now, just for fun, let's take Bernie Sanders and AOC. Let's take their suggestion. They're suggesting that you need to tax the billionaires more. Here's the problem with that. The aggregate net worth of America's billionaires, according to the Infernal Revenue Service, is $7 trillion. $7 trillion, that's what they're worth. If rather than increasing their taxes, you stole all their money, which is what many people would like to see, you would not pay down the debt a dime, and you would fund the increase in the on-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government for 3.5 years, or you would fund the combined deficit in on-balance sheet liabilities and in entitlement liabilities for 1.5 years. But if you did that, in other words, if you stole all of the capital of the billionaires, you would reduce income and capital gains tax income by 15% annually. I mean, this is such stupid math that it could only emanate from an envious Congress. There is no way a third grade or fourth grade math teacher who understood how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide would agree to a one-time hit that cost you 15% compounded for the rest of time.
Going back to the idea that capital goes where it's treated best, and so does productivity.
Well, in this particular case, you're not doing that. You're not diverting the capital. You're stealing it. Yeah. You are taking it from an entity which has proven that it can generate very high returns on capital employed, and you are giving it to a different entity, Congress, which has proven 100% of the time that they are an effective wealth-destroying machine. Would you rather the wealth grew, or would you rather the wealth disappeared? Those are the two choices. There's no middle ground.
Rick, I want to go back to the idea of kind of the energy scarcity, this energy shock that we're now facing. What do you see as the difference between, let's say, being in North America, Canada, the US, and the rest of the world, especially Asia right now? The UK and Australia today announced that there are more energy constraints and therefore restrictions coming. So do you see the same types of restrictions coming for North America, considering our ability to produce oil and gas?
I don't, but I see more taxes coming. You know, the United States and Canada are in a really, truly enviable position. We have substantial historic investment in oil and gas, and we are the best utilizers of oil and gas technology on the planet. The consequence of that is that even the United States, which is a large oil importer but a large oil exporter too, has a certain degree of energy certainty, particularly to the extent that they have access to surplus Canadian supply. That surplus Canadian supply has been guaranteed to the U.S. by the stupidity of Canada's parliament, which has, until very recently, decided that there wasn't a business case for Canadian oil and gas exports, despite the fact that Canada's allies have been clamoring for it. The consequence of the fact that the Canadians have refused to build infrastructure to allow the export of Canadian oil and gas to the Atlantic Basin or most of the Pacific Basin has meant, ironically, that they're captive suppliers to the United States. Almost pathologically stupid, to my benefit as an American, but to my detriment as an investor in Canadian oil and gas. There is plenty of oil and gas on a global basis, but it's a function of two things, price and peace. There is a lot of oil in the world available at $100 oil, a lot. It requires peace to get at it. And there's even more gas available to the world. The question is, at $100 a barrel, how much of the margin will government steal? And how much will the oil companies be allowed to invest? You know, those are going to be the questions.
Mm-hmm. Rick, you made a call earlier this year to sell some of your physical silver and to take those proceeds to buy miners. many were confused by this call, but I just want to understand what you based that move on.
I guess at my heart, Tom, I'm a mathematician. Experience and Mark, well, let's go back. I bought the silver because it was hated.
Yeah.
When you and I were first interviewing, you were on a very silver-centric channel. And I used to read the comments in your videos. And I noted during that first silver squeeze that your audience was euphoric. After that failed, your audience turned ridiculously hostile. The people who had silver as part of their internet handle were wishing that they had never learned to spell silver. And it went from being the object of fascination to the object of revulsion. There's nothing I like more in investment than hate. And when silver was hanging out at $20 an ounce and everybody hated it, I thought, you know, all silver needs to do is become less hated and the price goes up. And I think that's going to happen. Separately, I knew from prior bull markets that the consequence of debt and deficit was going to be reduced purchasing power of the U.S. dollar, which would mean increased nominal gold prices. And that when the momentum in gold attracted the attention of the generalist investor, that silver was going to begin to outpace gold. So silver seemed to me to be a great place to put my speculative money. My savings money was in gold and continues to be. But silver was so hated that I thought, you know, I could buy myself whatever amount of silver I could afford to speculate on. And it's highly likely that when the current circumstance, the then current circumstance of hate evaporated, that the silver price would go up. And that happened. In your speculative account, when the reason that you entered into the speculation occurs, you need to visit selling the speculation. I bought it because I thought it could go from 20 to 50. I was wrong. It went from 20 to 70. Well, higher than that. But at that period in time, I had to say, does silver still perform the same role in my portfolio? Mm-hmm. Is it still hated? No, it's not hated. Is it still 20? No. Could it go to 50? Well, if it did, that would mean a decline. And I've learned in my life that those hyperbolic charts that gets people so excited, in Canadian parlance, the hockey stick charts,
yep,
almost always resolve themselves very quickly to the downside. Similarly, hyperbolic charts to the downside almost always result in a correction to the upside. And so when I see a hyperbolic chart, I get excited, but not the way that other people do. I get excited to hit the bid, which I did. Now let's do the math. At $75 silver, which is approximately what I got for my silver, mercifully, I was lazy and I procrastinated, which made me probably 10 bucks an ounce. I would have sold at 65. Anyway, at 75, there was an interesting conundrum. The price of silver didn't have to go up. And I thought, okay, if silver traded sideways for a year, by definition, I'd make no money. Right? You own it at 75, it goes to 75, you're flat. If the silver price went up, I would expect the silver stocks to benefit from the price of silver going up. If the price of silver didn't go up, if it went sideways, the best silver producers in the world were trading at net asset value calculations or free cash flow calculations, assuming $45 silver. Mm-hmm. So the best silver producers in the world could still go up with a flat silver price, because the equity values hadn't adjusted to 75 silver. Paradoxically, if the silver price fell from $75 to $50, the silver stocks would still be appropriately priced. That isn't to say that they wouldn't trade down on sentiment, but the valuations needn't suffer. So it seemed to me that a more intelligent speculation, a more intelligent application of speculative capital, would be the silver stocks, which were positively geared but not negatively geared to the price of silver, rather than silver itself. I also took some of the money, and I took it mostly out of harm's way. I bought physical gold with it, which is to say, I put it into what I call my savings account. Did that shelter me? Well, in the near term, no. And I put some of the money into a then hated sector, which was oil and gas. Mm-hmm. Did that work for me? In spades.
Well, Rick, it's always good to try to temper some of that enthusiasm that I remember so much during, 2021.
Yeah.
We've seen it during the last couple months here too. And trying to get a reasonable and level-headed view on these hockey stick charts is Correct. Very difficult. And, it doesn't get nearly as many eyeballs or clicks, but I think it's far more responsible. And I do my best to try to evaluate both sides of that trade and that analysis for sure.
Well, all of us are going to begin to need to evaluate clicks. Those of us who are in social media, a view is not engagement. I've learned that I benefit in the long term myself much more from 1,000 people who view a 30-minute interview than I do from 100,000 people who have a 60-second hang time. Maybe that's a different way of saying there's some people who there is just no helping.
Mm-hmm. Rick, you've evaluated thousands of portfolios over the years. What's one pattern in how retail investors size positions or manage losers that consistently destroys wealth? How do you try to avoid that?
Investors consistently make several mistakes. The first is that they don't work hard enough. They don't know enough about what they buy. When I see an interesting portfolio, I often contact the owner of the portfolio and I debrief them, much to their surprise, by the way. and I say, why do you own this stock? Ooh, I don't know. Well, if you don't know, why do you own it? Well, Bob Bishop recommended it. Well, Bob Bishop been retired for 17 years. Is that a good reason? So when I ask people to explain to me the investment thesis and explain to me the underlying valuation that they see in a stock, 95% of the people can't answer the question, which means that their investment strategy has got a hunch bet a bunch, and that doesn't work.
Yeah.
The second thing is that most people are anti-contrarian. Most people would rather buy silver at $75 than $20, and that's just flat wrong. For most people, the narrative has to be proven by price action, but the price action devalues the narrative. The narrative is of no value if you pay too much for it. Mm-hmm. But most people can't help themselves. They require price action to demonstrate the validity of the thesis, which means they're too late. Mm-hmm. The third thing is that most people are impatient. Many people's strategy is good, but their tactics are terrible. If, as an example, you buy the copper thesis that 5 and 10 years from now, there's going to be a shortage of copper, and you buy copper, then the war comes, you have an economic slowdown, and the copper price falls in the near term as opposed to rises, you forget why you bought the copper. You forget that you had a 5-year thesis, and you apply a 6-week strategy. A 5-year thesis and a 6-week strategy isn't going to work for you.
Yeah.
The third thing is that most people can't stomach either cyclicality or volatility, which are different. High-quality junior mining companies are uniformly off 40% in 6 weeks. If that were involving physical goods, that would be called a sale.
Yeah.
But people don't want to buy sales. I've said it in interviews with you before, you may or may not recall, that we did a postmortem on my portfolio for 40 years on every stock that had given me a tenfold return or better. And one of the shocking things we learned was that almost every speculative 10-bagger or 20-bagger or 30-bagger that I enjoyed exposed me to a 50% share price decline during part of the period that I owned it. In the case of Pan American Silver, which went from 50 cents to $45, I was exposed to 4 separate 50% share price declines in the 7 years it took Pan American to go from 50 cents to $45. 4 separate 40% share price declines. People who are speculators need to come to grips with this. If they aren't prepared psychologically and financially, to deal with that if they aren't prepared to know enough about the valuation of the company that they welcome a 50% decline so they can buy more. They need to be much less risky with their investment portfolios.
Mm-hmm. Rick, as part of doing the work to understand some of these companies, what's one question if you could get every junior mining CEO to answer honestly before you'd even look at their project, what would one of those questions be?
There would be three, unfortunately. There is no one question. The first is, why should I care what you have to say? Tell me something about your background that makes you qualified to answer my questions about your company.
Yeah.
If you are exploring for silver in tertiary volcanics in the Altiplano of Peru, do you know something about epithermal silver deposits? Do you speak Spanish? Do you have some prior track record? At least looking for silver, but preferably looking for silver in Peru? If the answer to that is no, why would I care what you say? You know, it's like asking a sociology teacher to answer a math question. The second is, what's your company worth today? If you liquidated your company and sold the pieces, what are they worth? Now, you don't need to buy dimes for the dollar, but you need to understand if there's a $100 million market cap and there's a $10 million net present value, that your potential downside is 90%. Speculation is all about the juxtaposition of the upside to the downside. But almost no speculators calculate their downside. They don't ask the question. And many CEOs don't calculate it either. Not entirely for reasons of dishonesty, but rather for stupidity. But neither of those is a valid character trait in a CEO. And then the third thing I ask is, okay, give me your investment thesis. But give me your investment thesis in the context of the most important unanswered question that you're going to answer in the next 18 months. Tell me what you're going to do to increase the value of your deposit, but also increase the market certainty with regards to that value. Fully 80% of the time, I've asked people to explain to me the most important unanswered question. The management team has said, I've never thought of it in that context. Now, if you don't know where you're trying to go, it's very difficult getting there. It appears that for most managers, the most important unanswered question is, will they get paid their salary in 2027? And while I understand that's valid from their point of view, I could care less. I'm interested in how they increase the value of my speculative holding. And as a consequence of that, I want to know what the most important unanswered question is. I want to know how long it'll take to get an answer. I want to know management's assessment of the value of a yes answer, the probability of a no answer, how much money it'll take me to get that answer, and whether or not they have that money. That whole sequence of questions is very seldom asked.
So, Rick, we've seen much of the, let's say, the especially the gold and silver sector, energy sector, go on sale over the last couple weeks here. Understanding that you see a further risk here of a liquidity crunch, if you were buying, what were you buying over the last couple of weeks?
I'm on the bid. Sometimes stuff is cheap enough. And I personally have, even by my own cowardly standards, excess liquidity. But with the caveat that I view my gold holdings as liquidity, I know, because in 2009, I was willing to sell gold when there were other assets that were cheaper. Yeah. But for me, I will sell my gold if there are opportunities where my greed overwhelms my fear. So I have, if you include my gold and my cash, I have excess liquidity, which is, relative to many speculators and investors, probably a luxury. I am deeply committed to the gold equities trade. I may be wrong, and I'm committed to the extent that I can afford it, which is to say it's not 100% of my portfolio. But I believe that the gold price will do well over 10 years, and the gold equities over 10 years will do better despite cyclicality. So I'm a structural long. I also believe that the mantra around gold equities is going to change from fiscal discipline and return on capital employed to reserve replacement. And the only way that that happens in the 2 to 3 year timeframe is M&A. So I've looked at about 50 companies that I think are not unattractively priced, where I think that there is a potential buyer who could be viewed as strategic, somebody with an adjacent mine, somebody trying to do a regional consolidation. In other words, I looked for situations where there was a logical buyer in the market. The theory being that if the share price didn't rise organically, that the company would be taken over. And I've concentrated my efforts on those types of companies. If the best of the best continues to fall, which is to say, if Agnico Eagle, if Wheaton Precious, and if Franco-Nevada fall, I probably will again defer to buying the best of the best, which is, meaning I won't try to optimize my portfolio if that happens. I won't try to make 50% compounded. I'll try to make 25% compounded with a high degree of certainty. But thus far, the lower quality companies, the smaller companies, the single asset companies, the riskier companies have fallen much faster than the best of the best. And the consequence of that is that I have taken more performance risk in my portfolio, more operational risk in search of torque, and torque through mergers and acquisitions.
So is that the part of the cycle that we're now facing? Is this M&A type of area that we're getting into that is so much more attractive to you?
I think we're going to have an M&A feast in the next 5 years. I think the back part of the cycle will be very much like 2006, 2007, which is to say stupid M&A. But we aren't there yet. I think we have 2 years of strategic M&A. And if we don't, we'll have valuation arbitrage. And either way, we're in a stock picker's market. And we're in a stock picker's market where your entry prices are fair and reasonable, as opposed to where your entry prices were 2 or 3 months ago.
So, Rick, changing gears a little bit here. Katharina Reich, Germany's current economy and energy minister, publicly stated in late March 2026 that the country's phase out of nuclear power was a huge, huge mistake, and that Germany now misses that reliable, low-cost, CO2-free energy. How should investors think about this nuclear power generation thesis as an opportunity, both from the, let's say, raw commodity side, and as well as maybe the building and picks and shovels type side?
Well, first of all, Germany as a theme isn't one I'm willing to participate in yet. I need to see the German voter return to sanity. Those policies were highly popular in Germany. The German voter took collective leave of sanity, deciding to rely on solar in the far north where the sun doesn't shine. And I need to see some evidence of sobriety in Germany before I return as an investor there. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that the United States or Canada are rational. They're only rational by comparison. Back to your question. Unless we have a nuclear plant failure somewhere in the world, unless we have another Chernobyl or Three Mile Island or Fukushima, the road ahead is onwards and upwards. In the uranium business, everything is in place. The uranium price doesn't have to go up particularly. I think $85, if you had capital availability and regulatory assent, is sufficient. The problem with that is that we don't. And absent regulatory consent, and capital efficiency, the uranium price probably has to go up into the low triple digits. How to play it? Picks and well, I think really for most people, one company, Cameco. That company is already in the last 10 years a six bagger. I myself went on a buyer's strike after they bought Westinghouse because I was thinking, what do miners know about operating an engineering company? Well, the last 4 quarters suggest they know a lot. Westinghouse Hitachi is probably the best nuclear power technology in the world, in the hands of the best contractors in the world, partnered with Brookfield, one of the best financiers in the world, in a circumstance where the whole world is rapidly building nuclear power plants. Even in the United States, which hasn't had a greenfield plant, I mean, meaningful greenfield plants being built since 1982, has recently perhaps embarked on a building spree. President Trump, no need to believe he's telling the truth particularly, but President Trump has stipulated that the United States will spend $80 billion in new plant construction in a joint venture with Cameco, Westinghouse, and Brookfield. Nuclear plants are being built around the world. And one of the most important energy consequences of the Gulf crisis is the realization that for baseload power, particularly baseload power that doesn't generate carbon, the nuclear is the way to go. It is the only fuel in the world with the energy density sufficient to guarantee access to reliable electricity in developed economies. That's it, period, full stop. You can come down the quality trail if you want to. I have. There are some smaller companies that, as a consequence of the change from the spot market to the term market, will be able to access capital much more efficiently, lower their cost of capital, and hence increase the margins that they'll enjoy in the next 10 years. But for investors and speculators who either don't know how or don't want to take the time to understand those companies or understand the structure of the power market, the easiest way to play the game would be probably by the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust itself. Unless you believe that we're going to have sufficient regulatory and tax reform that we don't need for the uranium price to go up. I'm too cynical for that. Or else buy Cameco, where you have the largest, second largest, lowest cost, and most stable producer on the planet, as well as now the best implementer on the planet. In other words, sort of a one-size-fits-all stock. Now, listen. People don't understand how volatile these stocks are. Cameco could easily fall 25% in the next 12 months as opposed to go up. But trends in motion stay in motion until they stop. And the next 10 years should be extraordinarily bright for nuclear power, save for plant failure. If we have a plant failure, all bets are off. You just lost half your money overnight.
Well, that vertical integration of a uranium producer with an engineering firm seems like a great fit, as long as you mentioned that they have the ability to manage both of
As
those
long as you
styles
can run
properly.
it. I mean, what Cameco is constructing is amazing. They are putting together a company that can turnkey build on a fixed price contract a grassroots reactor from scratch. In other words, they'll say to a utility, for $8 billion, we will build you a plant and we will guarantee that we build you the plant. They want to go to miners, NexGen as an example, and say, we will build you a uranium mine, soup to nuts, for $6 billion or $7 billion. You can pre-sell some of the output on that plant in long-term contracts with uranium users and finance most of the cost of constructing the plant because we're turnkeying this plant. Now, they build margin in for doing that, make no mistake. Then they are miners of the material, but they may be off-takers of material too, because they want to be processors. They want to be fuel recyclers, And ultimately, I think you'll see them go into the waste storage business. In other words, you will see the first vertically integrated nuclear power company on the planet. From exploring for uranium, all the way to selling watts from plants they own, and recycling and disposing of waste material.
Do you know if there's any ideas in the pipeline to build, more SMR type plants, smaller than an $8 billion type plant, Rick?
Absolutely. And I think that'll be an important part of uranium demand. But I think it'll be an important part of uranium demand 7 years from now, 9 years from now, 10 years from now.
Right.
All you need to know about uranium demand is that the Japanese have no second choice now but to step up the pace of Japanese restarts, because those plants don't need to be built. They just need to be fueled.
Fueled and commissioned, yeah.
Right.
Rick, what's something that you've changed your mind about in the last 2 to 3 years regarding maybe energy, mining, or even monetary policy that has surprised even you?
I don't know if it surprised me, but we're coming into a new period of resource nationalism, and an increasing period of envy. And I think that the bad news around natural resources will be that societies will decide to steal them. Royalty, taxation, all that kind of stuff. And then again, it doesn't surprise me, but it disappoints me that envy is taking the place of optimism. I live in the People's Republic of Washington State. One of the reasons that I moved here was when I moved here, there was no income tax and there was no capital gains tax. Now they're both. And the state of Washington is surprised by the number of achievers who are leaving Washington State. I'm highly confident that the recent imposition of, by the way, an unconstitutional income tax in the state of Washington will be reduced tax revenues. The idea that the people in the in Washington who are subject to that tax pay a disproportionate amount of the taxes collected by the state. I live in a small town in Washington. Not a rich town, not a poor town either, but not a rich town. I was at a party 2 weeks ago with 25, 30 people. Four families in that party, not necessarily the movers and shakers of our town, four families are leaving. And they're leaving in odd circumstances because most of them have, well, probably all of them have very nice houses. They won't be able to sell because all the buyers are leaving. There's no sellers. They've just decided, that it's an unhealthy environment for them. And I'm talking about this in the context of Washington State, but the demands, the political demands around the world for a transfer of wealth from the people who generated it to the people who consume it. Which is to say, the politics of envy, as opposed to the politics of prosperity, are a real cause for concern, partly because I'm old and fat and bald and rich. For most of my life, society regarded me as a milk cow. Hard work and stuff, one end, and they stole some milk, blah, 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 blah. The difficulty, as Doug Casey points out, is when society's view of you goes from being a milk cow to being beef. That's an entirely different circumstance. Now, when I interact with society, what it seems to me that they'd like to do is cut off my hind quarter and consume it at a barbecue, as opposed to merely milking me over time. That's a very different level of commitment.
Well, Rick, on that bright note, feeding the feeding society as you interact with it. I know we're coming up against time here. Why don't you share with us some of your most exciting projects that are energizing you these days?
Got a bunch of them. The easiest for your folks to access would be to go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com and list their natural resource stocks. ruleinvestmentmedia.com. I will for free rank your natural resource stocks, and I'll comment on them if I think my comments might have value. Please no pot stocks, please no crypto, please no tech stocks, just natural resource stocks. Upcoming, we have the Copper Bootcamp, where we spend 8 hours on April 6th teaching you about the copper market. In the absence of a depression, an absolute no-brainer in the next 5 years. In order to participate rationally, you'll have to know something about it. Most people don't. So we propose to teach you in 8 hours enough of what you need to know that you will make money as opposed to lose money in the copper business for the next 5 years. Beyond that, our big annual event, the Rural Natural Resources Investment Symposium, takes place July 6th through 10. Live tickets for Boca Raton are no sold out. The conference is completely sold out. But online tickets, watching the conference from the comfort and convenience of your own home via live stream, is still very available and comes with an absolute ironclad money-back guarantee. If you think for any reason that we didn't give you enough value for the money, we'll give you your money back. Finally, one more commercial, Tom. Thank you for the opportunity. Anybody listening to this who is unhappy with their current bank ought to think about Battle Bank. Go to battlebank.com. Interest on your checking account. Interest on your business checking account. Banking in 20 currencies, not just the U.S. dollar. Metals equity line of credit, which means that you can access the capital that you have tied up in your stack without selling your stack. If you need working capital or access to liquidity for distressed real estate, deposit your metal with Battle Bank and borrow against it or have access to credit against it. Battlebank.com. By the way, no commercial real estate portfolio, no junk bond portfolio, no mismatch between assets and liabilities. A clean, sober, respectful bank. Battlebank.com.
And that's available to Canadian and U.S. customers, right?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. Rick, as always, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure, sir.
Pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.